Okay, so with that, do you want to introduce item 12, disability retirement process?
Okay, can you all view the covers page, Disability Retirement Overview?
Yes.
All right, this is agenda item number 12, and this is more of an information session on the disability process and what a disability application, the types we receive, what is required to submit and accept an application, the review process to the hearing process. The disability retirement general principles are SESERA members who are permanently incapacitated may be entitled to a disability retirement. The permanent incapacity for the performance of duty shall, in all cases, be determined by the Board of Retirement. The types of disability retirements that a member can file under. The first one is service connected, and that is where employment, the member's employment, contributed substantially to the member's incapacity. We have two different rules on what would make someone eligible to file the application. For example, for a safety tier one or a PEPRA tier four member, they would have to be permanently incapacitated from performing all of their job duties, or I'm sorry, any of their job duties. It could be, for example, if someone has a back injury, they are precluded from lifting more than 10 pounds. So it's an essential job function. For our Tier three and PEPRA Tier five, it falls under the substantial gainful employment provision. And we'll talk a little bit about more about that on some later slides. For a non-service connected disability, these are cases in which employment did not contribute to the employer or the member's incapacity. The same holds true. It's the same provisions for safety tier one and PEPRA tier four that they're unable to perform their job duties. And under the tier three and PEPRA five, it's substantial gainful employment.
Tim, before we leave this page, it jumped out to me maybe in future iterations. If you look at the first bullet last sentence, employment must have contributed substantially. Then you look down on non-service connected disability, last sentence, employment did not contribute to the member. Well, I think we probably want substantially in there.
Okay.
But otherwise, employment certainly could have contributed, but would still not qualify for service connected.
Right. Okay. Thank you, John. Moving on to slide three, the excuse me, where I was mentioning substantial gainful employment. Substantial gainful employment disability is a standard found in statute. It was enacted by the California legislature in 1980 as Government Code Section 31720.1. At the time, it was applicable to Tier 1. Over the years, through legislation, it has been made applicable to Tier 3 and to Tier 5. Pursuant to the statute, permanent incapacity for SESERA Tier 3 and Tier 5 members means the member is unable permanently to engage in any substantial gainful employment. Continuing under substantial gainful employment, the Board of Retirement adopted standards on determining substantial gainful employment on April 16th, 1991, as follows. Substantial gainful employment is work activity that involves physical or mental effort, regardless of time spent. Two, gainful employment is work activity that is done for pay or profit, whether or not the profit is realized, including work as a self-employed individual. In general, employment will be considered gainful if the monthly salary from that employment is equal to or exceeds the greater of either A, $300 a month, or the initial monthly disability benefit. Continuing on substantial gainful employment, inability will be determined using the following factors. And again, this applies to our Tier 3 and our PEPRA Tier 5 members. Previous work experience, education or training, whether formally obtained through schooling or informally obtained through work experience, transferability of knowledge, skills, and abilities to perform other work, the extent to which chronological age affects the ability to adapt to new work settings. And then lastly, the existence of jobs in one or more occupations having requirements that the member is able to meet and that lie within a 100-mile radius of the member's residence, regardless of whether a specific job vacancy exists or the member would be hired if he or she applied for the position, or whether the member wishes to do a particular job. In the determination of substantial gainful employment, SACERA engages the services of an independent vocational specialist to perform an analysis to determine if an applicant meets SACERA's definition of substantial gainful employment. In making this determination, the vocational specialist will take into account the applicant's work restrictions set forth by the treating physician and IMEs, prior work experience, education or training, transferability of knowledge, skills, and abilities, and the extent to which chronological age affects the ability to adopt a new work setting. Based on this information, the vocational specialist drafts a report identifying the existence of suitable jobs that the applicant is able to meet the job requirements and that lie within a 100-mile radius of the applicant's residence. Now we're going to take a look at the benefit that a disability applicant is eligible for or could be eligible for. For Tier 3 and Tier 5, for both service-connected and non-service-connected disabilities, it is 40% of the highest 36-month average salary, plus if they have minor children, plus an additional 10% of final average salary for minor children up to 3, or the regular service retirement if greater. The disability benefit for Tier 1 safety and PEPRA Tier 4, it's slightly different. The service connected disability amount is 50% of the highest final 12-month average salary or regular service retirement if greater, and it is possible that up to 100% of the retirement allowance could be non-taxable. For a non-service-connected disability, it generally equals one-third of the highest 12-month average salary, although it could be less depending upon the age of the applicant and retirement service of the applicant or more if the service retirement is greater. It is a taxable benefit. For safety C and for PEPRA Tier 4, it's a 36-month average salary in both cases. The eligibility to file an application for service connected. For all tiers, a disability retirement application may be filed at any time during employment. For a non-service connected disability, it's slightly different. If you're Tier 1, safety, or PEPRA 4, it's after completing at least 5 years of retirement service credit. And for Tier 3 and PEPRA 5, it's after completing at least 10 years of retirement service credit. when can they file an application? Well, it's a member can file an application while they're in service within 4 months after they discontinue service, within 4 months after the expiration of any period during which a presumption is extended beyond the member's discontinuance of service. And we'll go through the presumptions in a moment. And then lastly, while from the date of discontinuance of service to the time of application, he or she is continuously physically or mentally incapacitated to perform his or her duties. For CSERA to accept an application, the member must fully complete the disability application and provide at least one acceptable medical report. The medical report must be from the treating physician who is under the opinion the member meets CSERA's standard of permanent incapacity as outlined in the statute, and the burden of proof of the permanent incapacity resides with the member. The burden of proof is on the applicant. An applicant must prove the existence of the permanent incapacity by a preponderance of the evidence to the Board of Retirement and to the courts. For service-connected disabilities as a convenience, CSERA will reach out to risk management or to the employer's work comp carrier to request medical information. On non-service-connected disabilities, it is up to the member to provide the records to CSERA and what goes to the medical advisor. The evidence, it must be competent medical evidence, is required to support the disability claim. CSERA requires the submission of medical reports supporting the disability application. If, for example, if we go to risk management and then there are future reports, risk management does not automatically provide those updates to CSERA. In those cases, it is up to the applicant to get that information from risk management and provide it to CSERA.
Hey, Tim?
Yeah.
Question, and this is actually from probably two or three slides prior. In the case of an application filed posthumously, does the same 4 month period apply? So from, if you're applying for someone who's deceased to file a disability application post-death, does it have to be within 4 months of the date of death?
I'm hesitating for a second. Have we encountered that? I believe so. It would be within 4 months of the date of death. It could be, you know, a time period where they're not aware that that option may be available to them. It really depends upon the circumstances. In some cases, we've had individuals start the disability process, and then during the process, they pass away, and we will continue the process through its completion. But the same would hold true if someone passes away, that could be their employer, family member, other party could submit a disability application on their behalf. And again, the eligibility for the disability, for example, say for a continuance, the beneficiary would still have to be an eligible beneficiary to receive a continuance.
Right. Okay. Yeah. We had a case recently, I think in the last couple of months. So I was just curious about the time frame.
We hit a lot of these as we start going through the pro, you know, a lot of these, we've had bits and pieces hit over the last, like in a 12 month period.
Great. Thank you.
No problem. So one of the key pieces with the medical evidence is the member's ability to do essential work-related activities, such as walking, sitting, lifting, carrying, and understanding and remembering instructions. And again, it's what are the member's restrictions. For our tier one safety and tier four, again, we're looking at essential job function essential job functions and the ability not to be able to fulfill all of them. And then with our tier three and tier five, it's substantial gainful employment. Okay, if the member is seeking service connected, they must provide evidence that the incapacity is a result of injury or disease arising out of and in the course of the member's employment. And we keep going back, reminding the evidence has to be substantial. The presumptions, and this applies to safety members. Safety members are afforded four different presumptions. We have the heart presumption, which we encounter occasionally. We've had the cancer presumption, bloodborne infectious disease, and biochemical substance. Safety members are relieved of the burden of proving their illness arose out of and in the course of the employment when a presumption applies. But the permanent incapacity must still be proven with medical evidence, as well as the presumptions are rebuttable. Once the department receives all of this information and the file is complete, it will all be assembled and transmitted to the board's medical advisor for review. The medical advisor will issue their preliminary recommendation based on and summarizing the evidence or the lack of evidence supporting the recommendation. In some cases, we'll get a lot of medical information. However, restrictions are omitted from any of the medical records provided. In order for the medical advisor to make a recommendation, he needs to be aware of what the work restrictions are or the limitations. If the medical advisor's primary recommendation is to grant the application, the matter is placed on the agenda for the board to consider. Final determination to grant a disability application always resides with the board. If the medical advisor cannot recommend granting the application based on the evidence submitted, CSERA staff will advise the applicant that they have the following options: submit additional medical evidence or other evidence in support of the application, which we will then forward to the medical advisor for additional review and another recommendation, or the applicant can request a hearing before a hearing officer within 6 months of the date of the letter informing the member that the medical advisor is unable to recommend granting. If the applicant doesn't request a hearing or submit additional medical evidence, the application is closed 6 months after the date of the initial notice of the medical advisor's recommendation. When a hearing is requested, or, and it could be by board direction also, I have not encountered one of those, but I know previously the board has had made similar direction. More information may be attained through discovery. The complete file is sent to the board's disability council, and that those are external to CSERA. An independent medical evaluation may be completed in order to obtain current restrictions pertaining to the disability. And then the tier three and PEPRA tier five members will have all work restrictions set forth by treating physicians and IMEs evaluated by a vocational expert to determine if they're able to engage in substantial gainful employment. The hearing process is, we'll file the case with the Office of Administrative Hearings in Oakland. All evidence is submitted to the office. The case is heard before an administrative law judge. The administrative law judge issues a report and recommendation to the board, normally within 30 days of the hearing date. All parties are notified and provided with an opportunity to respond to the proposed recommendation. Following that time period, it will be placed on the agenda for board action. And again, final determination resides with the board. When we go to a hearing, the board will consider the proposed findings of fact and recommend its decision on a date notice to all parties so that everyone has an opportunity to participate in that portion of the board meeting. Any party or his or her counsel may request the opportunity to make an oral presentation to the board. However, no new evidence or witness testimony may be heard or received by the board. And then the board can take one of the following four actions: approve and adopt the proposed findings and recommendation of the hearing officer, refer the matter back to the hearing officer for further proceedings with or without instructions, or require a transcript or summary of all of the testimony plus all other evidence received by the hearing officer. And after receipt thereof, the board shall take action as it determines is warranted by the evidence, or the board could set the matter for hearing before itself. And at such a hearing, the board shall hear and decide the matter as if it had not been referred to the hearing officer. That's a high level review of the disability process. There's a lot of small, very detailed processes and steps that take place in between. And see if you have any questions about it.
Any questions from Tim? David?
Tim, one thing that jumped out to me that I somehow had never quite recognized before was the 10% for each minor child additional lifetime benefit. Have we ever had one of those? And what's the background for the rationale of that?
Yeah, we have had some. It's not, I'm going to say very often, but it's on the tier three and the tier five. We've encountered it on tier three, and that's where there's a minor child. The minor child would receive a 10%. Well, the funds would be paid to, in most cases, say to the spouse, the surviving spouse, and they would have an adjustment to account for the child until the child attains the age of 18, and then it would stop, or the age when they attain the age of 22 if they're in college.
All right, so there is an endpoint.
Yes.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, it's not a lifetime benefit in those cases. And in some cases, if it's a minor child, and depending upon, say, the minor child is the beneficiary, and depending upon the age of the minor child, in some cases, a withdrawal of contributions and the death benefit is more beneficial financially than a disability benefit, since it will cease when the minor child is no longer a minor.
David.
Yeah.
Tim, doesn't the person still have a right to go to Superior Court at the hearing and say it's denied the disability?
There is a provision that we've had come up, and that is if we go through the hearing process and the board elects or determines to deny an application. And it could be accepting the hearing officer's recommendation to deny. It could also be the board not following those directions, but they do have the opportunity to file a writ. And in those cases, they should be looking for a flaw in the process.
Right, going to Superior Court with that, right?
Yeah, exactly. And CARE, I mean, I'm aware of one recently, and there may have been two. It's fairly rare that it happens, but it does happen occasionally where they do not feel the outcome was correct, and then it does go to the courts.
Thank you.
David.
Okay. I wanted to get a big picture view of all this and its significance. What impact on the CSERA system does a disability have? In other words, we as a board have to approve or disapprove disability applications. And we do so because we're looking after CSERA and there is a potential impact on CSERA. So if we have people who are getting disability, how does that affect CSERA in general?
As far as like the funding portion of it?
Well, is there extra expense? Someone can be declared disabled and we can grant that and so forth. They might be, that might happen to them earlier than they normally would retire. So I guess there's a potential financial impact there. But I'm just getting a big picture of what this is all about because we have to make these decisions on behalf of CSERA because there has to be an impact on CSERA. Otherwise, why would we be making these decisions?
Right.
And then it's my understanding that this whole process is in place to actually protect the rights of individuals to obtain a disability retirement if it's appropriate to do so.
Okay.
Is that correct?
Yes. And now, and going through your question, if you take, say, a 10-year member that files for a service-connected disability and they're tier one, tier five, or safety, since that benefit would be a 50% payout or calculated benefit, the system or the funding of the program would be impacted in those cases because you're paying a greater benefit than what has been funded to date. Now, if we take, say, a 20-year, which we see, in some cases, like a 20-year plus safety member, financially, while the member is living, the benefit, the 100%, payout, to say the unmodified, the system at that point is whole. However, the beneficiary for a service-connected disability is eligible to receive the 100% continuance under an unmodified rather than the 60%, normal 60%. In those cases, it would be costing CSERA, the plan, the employer, more funds than what was funded. And I believe that's one of the reasons on the semi-annual report, we added the information where the board asked, where we had maybe short time or shorter period members applying for service-connected disabilities was to identify that. But you have two things. If they don't have the service and they're receiving a benefit that is greater than what they would have received in a service retirement, it's a cost to the system. If their service retirement is the better or the greater benefit, it's when the beneficiary starts receiving payment that it turns to costing, spending more money than that what was funded.
Okay, and then the other aspect is that if someone is granted disability, then a portion of their income would be tax-free. But CSERA doesn't necessarily care about that, right? That's more of an IRS state tax issue than it is for us.
Yeah, on a service-connected basis, the tax, if it's a service retirement and it's $10,000, we'd be, upon the member's direction, withholding taxes and reporting the income to the state and to the IRS. In the case of a service-connected disability, up to the 50% of their average salary, final average salary, would be tax-free. And that's coming more, I'm going to say, at the expense of the government, or the federal government and state are not collecting funds, since those dollars are not taxable.
Which is why it falls to us to make that determination, because the IRS is saying we are obligated to do that.
Correct. Yeah, they're ensuring that we are following the rules and we have a solid process in place in that determination. And even if you notice, when we get to the presumptions, you know, we still dig into the presumptions, and we're looking for that connection of, if someone's applying under the cancer, it's under what carcinogen? What's the link to their job? And kind of connecting those dots to show there is a service connection.
David, I also wanted to address the kind of the part B answer to your question on, you know, the impact of SSERA, because Tim went over kind of what happens with the benefits and the differences there. But also when it comes to the valuation report, you know, our SSERA's actuary Siegel has disability incidence assumptions at, you know, different ages, different tiers are going to have a certain rates of disability. And so if there is a higher than expected number that we're seeing, that could impact the rates. So, and that's something that's looked at every 3 years with the experience study. So there's the benefit impact that Tim went over, and then also the incident assumption portion.
Okay, thanks. That's helpful. It's good to have the big picture view of what all this means to SSERA itself, and why the retirement board goes through this exercise. But basically, we're looking after the system in that manner to make sure that if there is an early retirement, that it's appropriate, you know, based on the evidence for the disability and so forth, because that will impact the system overall.
Anyone else have any questions for Tim? Hearing none, thank you, Tim, for that presentation.
Thank you very much.